White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Gentlemen and students of the International Jew. It is August 8th, 2013. I am Carolyn Yeager and
Padding Scott here.
And tonight we begin chapter 54, more about the Jews' involvement in Tammany Hall in New York City. Yeah. And I think this chapter is more interesting than the previous one, Hadding. What do you think?
It's pretty good.
Well, it is pretty good. And, I think it's one of the better ones, and so I think people are going to really enjoy it.
There's some good pithy statements in it.
That's it. It's very damning. It's very damning, and it tells so many truths that are just universal truths, the way these people act, and here they are acting just that way in this situation. And I think that it implies and assumes major conspiracies among the Jews to gain control of Tammany Hall. And as part of their larger quest to control New York City, which was again behind their quest to control the United States of America. And that's what the chapter, what the writers say more towards the end or something, but they believe this. And I'm not sure that you do. This whole conspiracy thing, maybe I'll just go ahead with my question about Carl Rattle. On Monday, I talked about him on my Heretics Hour program. And I was talking about how he is on record as saying that the Jews are not behind these big conspiracies that people say they are. And that's a mistake to think that, and he thinks it's harmful to the anti-Jewish movement. And he presents himself as real anti-Jewish, but not he doesn't believe a whole lot of things that the rest of us do about the Jews. And he says that what the Jews are doing is they're simply following their nature, which is to be big egoists. And they crave attention and admiration and things like that. And that's what leads them into all that they do. But it's the International Jew does accept the conspiracy idea. And I think it's in this chapter. So what would you say about all that?
Well, you've indicated two extreme positions, which would be, to simplify a little bit, the protocols of the learned elders of Zion on the one hand, mm-hmm. Where there's a conscious conspiracy on a comprehensive global scale to take over, and a big conscious and deliberate conspiracy encompassing all Jews, basically. And on the other hand, Carl Rattle there, who is using the name of an SS man, who's saying...
Are you sure that this SS man was real and not fictional? Because I was looking him up, too, and all of a sudden I couldn't really find much.
Actually, I think he was an underling of Otto Skorzeny. He may not have been an SS man.
Well, no, that's it. Well, he would have been... That's what I've been saying, but when I looked it up, I didn't find right off the bat much evidence of that. But I didn't spend much time on it either. But he also plays a big role, somebody named Carl Rattle, who's an SS guy, in this book, fiction book. They made a big movie out of it. See, now I can't think of it. Oh, it's probably here.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time they made fiction using the names of real people from Germany, would it?
Yeah, no, right. Yeah, you assume. But
most
his
of
role
what
in
we
this,
see about
in this
the,
movie was a little different from what it actually was. But well, I thought you might. Fiction. I don't know. I think we need to get more clarity on that, on just who.
Well, I've seen some of what Carl Rattle had to say about things, and I argued with him on VNN Forum. I think he goes. He has some valid points, but he goes too far. That's my view. he makes the point that a lot of the reports about Jews in relation to Bolshevism are not accurate. And that's true. A lot of the material from the early days of Bolshevism has mistakes in it, like listing Mensheviks as Bolsheviks. But at the same time, Karl Rattle goes too far, and he wants to say, well, I'll just say that. He goes too far with his skepticism.
He's known as saying here, where's this Bolshevik point here, he denies that Bolshevism is a Jewish phenomena. That's what Metapedia says.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I have on my National Socialist Worldview blog a page from a book published by Oxford University Press, which is...
Well, I know we've talked about this before. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead with that. But we don't want to get too much on Bolshevism because we're trying to talk about...
It has the minutes...
The whole...
It has the minutes of the first... It has the minutes of the meeting of the Bolshevik Central Committee. Mm-hmm. From October 1917, just before the Bolshevik takeover. And 8 out of 12 members of the Bolshevik Central Committee had Jewish ancestry. And we just had Putin come out and say that 85% of the early Bolshevik leadership, I'm not sure how broad he meant that, but the 85% were Jews. Now,
yeah, so a lot of what Karl Rattle says is just, to me, it's just ridiculous.
There's some things that, you know, there's some criticisms that he makes are valid, but he carries it way too far, in my opinion.
But you think that the conspiracy thing is carried too far.
It can be, yeah. I mean, there are conspiracies, but to theorize about a gigantic overarching conspiracy with everything put into writing is...
Well, nobody is saying that. I don't think there's... You know, I'm not saying that, and I don't think the International Jew is saying that. But the fact that that the Jews do conspire, and they conspire at a high level, but I'm not saying that, oh, they have this overarching all over the world and they're in control of everything. And no, I'm not, you know, it doesn't have to be that. But he is saying that, that conspiracies about the Jews, conspiracy theories about the Jews or whatever is wrong.
There is malevolence on the part of many Jews toward non-Jews. There is definitely Jewish malevolence, and it's manifest in the form of their claims of persecution. Because what you do is you claim that you're being persecuted, and then that justifies whatever kind of nasty thing you want to do.
Well, I think it has to start somewhere, and I think that this has been going on for a long, long time. And anyway, so we'll let the listeners decide, pay attention to whether you think what's going on here in Tammany Hall and New York City and so on is conspiratorial among the Jews. And it's, in my mind, it's definitely conspiratorial among the Jews. I don't have to say from this that, oh, well, that means that they're, you know, part of a worldwide thing that's totally planned out and written out and so on. No, but I think they did have their desires here in the U.S. to take over the as much of the United States as they could, you know. And they started with what they had in New York, and they got into Tammany Hall, which was the big power in that city from early on. Mm-hmm. So that's just the kind of an introduction. Do you want to comment more on that? Or?
Not really. We can just get started here.
Okay. All right. Well, then we'll just get started. Go ahead.
This is a quote from a Jew named Norman Hapgood. I need hardly explain that I do not think Jews ought to insist overmuch on their rights or nationality in a negative sense. They ought to be as much Jews as they can, but ought to be as little as possible of what is merely anti-Christian. for the Jews to try to get a song out of the public schools because it praises Jesus is natural, but perhaps hardly wise. I admit that question, however, is an extremely complex and baffling one. Again, the Jews have naturally taken a great interest in this war. But in that case also, they ought to choose as far as possible the more tolerant view. Too much hostility to Russia was shown, it seems to me, when some of their spokesmen were fighting over the wording of the Immigration Act. They seemed to be fighting not for a real gain, but simply to rub their political power in America into the Russian mind. And that's Norman Hapgood, a Jew.
Right. And I want to mention here, he says twice, he uses the word natural, or he says he thinks it's natural for Jews to want to get a song about Jesus out of the public schools. And he thinks they naturally taken a great interest in the war, but in this war. And why is all this so natural for Jews? Of course, he's a Jew, too. But I would just say that if I was, if I went and lived in Israel and I put my child in a school there, I certainly would not think that I should start telling them that they can't sing songs about whatever their religious songs are, you know, Moses or something. No way would I think that, no way would that naturally come to me. I'd realize that I'm amongst those people and they're going to do it their way. But the Jews can't realize that they're amongst Christian people, and they want to make that that change. So that right there, you know, it's just so irritating the way these people think. Okay.
Okay. So here we're into the text of the article.
Well, we didn't give the title yet, so read the title.
Oh yes. Jew wires direct Tammany's Gentile puppets. That's kind of contemptuous, the way that's worded. Jew wires.
Yeah, well, I guess they want to make it short.
Yeah. Not Jewish. Not trying to be polite here.
Right.
The proposal that non-Jews emigrate from New York City, 500,000 in the first exodus and 500,000 in the second, to hasten the event which is held to be certain of occurrence, namely that New York shall become an all-Jewish city, may be a joke. But it is no joke that the Jews themselves discuss and have proposed that the city of New York be separated from the state of New York and made both a city and a state in itself. Probably upstate New Yorkers would be happy to see that. This would entail three governments, state, county, and municipal, whose offices the Jews could parcel out as they pleased. Besides, it would rid them of Albany. It is a most amazing fact that the state capital, bad as it is, has always been able to defeat the New York Jew in his most ardently pursued quests, as notably his insistent appeal to abrogate the Sunday law. Of course, if the non-Jews emigrated from New York, the Jews would soon follow. They are not self-sufficient. If New York could be isolated, Jewish initiative would not suffice to provide enough potatoes for the inhabitants.
See, I thought that was pretty good. That's so true, they're not, and they knew that.
Right. Yeah, even in their state of Israel, they have Arabs to do things like carpentry for them.
Yeah, they're helpless people.
It is too trite to say that New York is already in the hands of the Jews. But it would be most startling to give a schedule illustrating how completely this is so. The New Yorker himself can scarcely comprehend the extent of his vassalage to the Jew. The average intelligent New Yorker does not know what the Kehila is, nor yet how it works. Like the child born within sound of Niagara Falls, The New Yorker takes Jewish supremacy as a matter of course, the way things should be, and as the way they probably are everywhere. The New Yorker is thus like a native of the Balkans. The Hyland administration, ostensibly non-Jewish, is really Jewish, as any New York administration must necessarily be, except there should arise a man whose ambition would be to prove that New York could be better governed if the Jews should be excluded from the government. Well-informed New Yorkers say that the power of Hyland is Hirschfeld.
In other words, the man behind Hyland is Hirschfeld, the Jews.
Yes.
Right.
This is a rather peculiar situation to those who do not understand how the Jewish leaders work. Directly, you say the Hyland administration is Jewish. It is objected. But it is the arch-Jewish inquisitor, Untermeyer, who is trying to break down the Hyland administration. Exactly. That is the game. It's inside and outside that does it. There is power gained in making them, and there is power gained in breaking them. And often it is profitable to try both ways with the same man. That is the way Russia went. There were Jews plentifully sprinkled throughout the government of Russia, in spite of the persecution, and there were Jews outside. Between the two, they got Russia. It is the same in a Texas city today. Four non-Jewish candidates for postmaster were made the center of a political deadlock. Up through the deadlock pops a Jew as a compromise candidate for all sections. A sufficient number of Jews were available in that city to keep all the non-Jewish candidates in a deadlock until their own man was trotted out. The Gentile mind, of course, does not easily recognize these turnings and twistings of group conspiracy, and that is why the Jews feel safe as a rule. They rely on what they call Gentile stupidity. The Gentile says, incredible. And the traditional Jewish game is incredible until by mountainous proofs and centuries of illustration, the actuality of it is forced home to the mind.
I thought this was just great. And of course, they do use the word group conspiracy here. And they mean that, you know, that's what they're doing. So it can be smaller ones. There's a conspiracy in this Texas city, they're saying, for this, to get this Jew in as postmaster without it looking like, you know, we really, a Jew is going after it. This guy just...
You know, actually that doesn't necessarily need to have been something that they consciously planned. It can
well,
be...
Well, we don't know, you know, you don't know, but...
Just Jews being Jews. In other words, you know, as soon as somebody is proposed that's a Jew, that overrides ideological and party differences, and the Jews get together and say, yes, we want him. You know, that could be how it works, rather than, you know, a deliberate conspiracy.
It's, you know, it's still a conspiracy, because they're still deciding we're all going to put this Jew in.
Well,
it's
subconscious.
No matter how, it's not subconscious. They certainly know what they're doing. It couldn't be subconscious. And just as what they say, they know it's Gentile stupidity, or it's just the unwillingness of Gentiles to believe it. As I think, you know, we're seeing here, because here they're saying, I don't know what actually happened here, and maybe, you know, maybe they're not telling it the way it actually happened, but they're saying that there were four candidates, and they had enough Jews around the town to, keep them all in a deadlock. So maybe they were spreading the word to, you vote for this guy, you go for that guy, you go for the other guy. And then they were able to bring their Jewish guy in at that point. I don't see anything outlandish about that.
Well,
I can believe that.
It's possible, but I think it's unlikely that it worked that way.
Well, okay, all right.
More likely just Jews being Jews. But to return to the New York City government, the police department has its Jewish streak in the higher offices. A Jewish police commissioner who has fortunately escaped thus far the full story of his career. The Department of Health, where it actually touches the people, is Jewish, although occasionally a distinguished non-Jewish name meets the eye in the roster of the higher officials. The public health is becoming more and more a Jewish monopoly in all our cities. The Department of Accounts, the Board of Child Welfare, the Board of Inebriety, the Municipal Service Commission, the Board of Taxes and Assessments, are all under the leadership and domination of Jews.
Now, let's just stop right here real quick. So if Jews were at the most at any time, 10%, I think, of the, aren't they, of the New York City population?
Not sure.
And
I know,
so,
it's the biggest concentration of Jews in the world.
Yeah. Boy, I'm imagining 25% figure I've seen somewhere, but that's not possible. That's not possible, I don't think. Maybe in some sections it was that way, some areas. So anyway, how do they get all these positions? How are they in charge of so many things? If they weren't, you know, if they didn't work together more consciously, it certainly is not unconscious that it happens, I would just say.
Well, they're supporting each other, and some of them, you know, McDonald talks about this, how Jews are self-deceiving about a lot of their ethnocentric behavior, even when, you know, they think that they're not doing anything particularly Jewish. They're fooling themselves, you know.
But that's not the same thing. What we're talking about here is that they got control, and they had an intention, the leadership had an intention, we're going to get control of New York City as much as possible. And they start out, and they're working at putting people here and there. So they have to, you know, they're talking, you know, that goes down the hierarchy. They're talking to Jews here and there and encouraging them to run for this and do that. And all with the idea of representing the Jews, you know, representing your people, you know, to make things better for your people. We have to make things better for we Jews here because we've been so persecuted. We don't, you know, that whole story. And so they're all encouraged to do that. And they're doing it. And we don't do that. And
well,
we don't act as a group with our group interests. That's all. I don't want to take up any.
Not very strongly anyway. I think a conspiracy in the case of New York City is more credible, because you're talking about Jewish organized crime, among other things. That, you know, he talks later on in the article and also in the previous one about so-called white slavery that became associated with the, you know, Jewish takeover in New York City. So part of it is that, you know, organized crime is certainly a conspiracy, and if you're taking over a government for the purpose of getting away with things like that, that's a conspiracy for sure.
Well, you know what? When I think that the chapter is kind of shorter, I think there's lots of time, and then next thing I know, it's getting later, and we're gonna move right along.
The judiciary becomes increasingly Jewish. Litigation is almost overwhelmingly Jewish. And the consequences to the reputation of the courts of justice and the profession of the law are well understood. Real estate exploitation and speculation must necessarily be, except there should arise a man... Okay, something weird.
What I have. No, it's strictly Jewish.
I've got this new version of Foxit Reader, and it acts weird on me here.
Real estate exploitation and speculation is strictly Jewish. The profiteers treating even their own co-nationalists with the utmost cruelty. Got it?
I'm still trying to get back to my page.
Okay. In short, New York's most influential press within New York is the Yiddish press. New York's real government is the Yiddish Kahila, New York's real administration is the law of the New York's real administration of the law is the Yiddish administration. New York's real politics is Jewish. A little more and New York's official language would be the Yiddish dialect.
Yes.
Ha!
In all this, Tammany Hall is little more than a name. It is one of the rallying centers which the Jews have left the non-Jew, who still interests himself in New York politics. There must be rallying places for the non-Jews, and one or two do not hurt. The Jew has the double advantage in such a matter, for while he claims equality with all, he denies equality with any. That is, any Jew proclaims his right to join any fraternity or any club or any society or any party whose members are chiefly non-Jewish. But where is the Jewish fraternity or club or society that admits non-Jewish members? The newspapers carried the report after a certain occurrence that hundreds of Jews had offered to join the Knights of Columbus. It was very typical of Jewish character. But let any non-Jew attempt to join the B'nai B'rith, or the Hebrew Young Men's Association, or the Menorah Society, or any of the others. He will see how far the principle of equality operates. We want to be part of yours, but we want our own for ourselves, is the Yiddish attitude.
You know, I wonder if I could join the Anti-Defamation League.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd be very helpful.
Well, but I mean, I wonder if,
you know, maybe.
They would they let me in? I mean, this is so true that they won't let anybody into their organizations unless they're Jewish, just like they won't let anybody into Israel unless they're Jewish. But they want to come everywhere of yours and join, get into your things. People should remember that. That's one big mark against them.
So, politically, the New York Jew has the advantage. He belongs, together with the non-Jew, to organizations like Tammany or the Republican Club, but the non-Jew cannot, with him, belong to the Kehillah.
Hmm.
It is also very familiar. The Jew insists on double everywhere. In the Balkans, he insists on a double citizenship. He insists on a double protection. He insists on a double standard of education. He insists on all his own religious rights as strenuously as he insists that all Christian majority rights shall be stamped out in this country. He insists that he shall have his Sabbath and that you shall not have yours. He wants his own social rights and yours too. But he wants you to have only your own and not his with it. It casts serious doubts on Jewish intelligence that this course should be so seriously pursued, as if on the one hand the humor of the nerve and on the other hand the disgusting impudence of it had never appeared to his consciousness.
Yep.
In New York, therefore, the Jew politically belongs twice, while all non-Jews belong but once, and it can easily be perceived that this is an advantage. In the previous article, it was rehearsed how Tammany besmirched its name by association with Jews who used the organization as a protection for their traffic in vice. This was in 1894. The revelations were so terrible that in any other community, they would have led to a complete abolition of any possible chance of recovery. But as it was never made plain to the people that the traffic in vice was not a sudden appearance of rottenness among Americans, but was the normal activity of an alien racial strain, the moral power of exposure was dissipated. The people were left staggered by what they were allowed to believe about the origin of the horror. People said it was Tammany because the press said it was Tammany. And yet people could not understand how it could be Tammany. And so in the midst of hesitancy the fire of reform burned out. It was exactly like these days when we are told that American businessmen abroad are doing terrible things. Yet even while the press declares them to be American, we cannot understand how Americans could do such things. And we never get the key to the matter, nor see the solution, until we stumble onto the fact that these so-called Americans are not Americans at all, but alien Jews. Over in Canada, the name American is becoming a stigma because it is borne by men who are not Americans. What Canadians point out in the United States as definitely American is mostly Jewish. But how are the Canadians to know? The national name is suffering. The whole cause of evil is camouflaged, and a nation pays the price of a racial group's misdeeds. There should be some method of protecting this forging of national names.
Well, that's right. I think it's just a shame. What a shame that what these people have done to this country and even, you know, still going on today. I hate my own country, and it's all because of these Jews, what the Jews have done with it.
And certainly these Middle East wars for Israel are not helping the image of the United States.
No.
Thus, Tammany became a synonym for what was not characteristically Tammany at all, but what was characteristically Jewish. The exposure of 1894 disclosed that vice was really a thing of cold blood. Evil that springs from passion and impulse really amounts to far less than is commonly supposed. It is when passion is deliberately cultivated and impulse stimulated that the great bulk of the world's social evil occurs. And this stimulation is undertaken in cold blood by those who make profit out of providing the means of gratification, like the old-fashioned barkeepers who served very salty free lunches to stimulate the sale of beer. This kind of vice is not a thing to be shamed by exposure, as can be done with involuntary vice, as it might be called. This cold-blooded merchandising of human weakness was merely a matter of profits, and if business had been interfered with by a Lexow committee, it was rather unfortunate, but good business required that operations be resumed at the earliest possible moment. And so, though the investigations of 1894 were successful and the exposure duly made, it was not to be expected that mere oratory and printer's ink would suffice to keep the serpent down. It was only 7 years before scandal flamed again throughout the length and breadth of New York. And strange enough, in all conscience for Gentile fronts of this day and generation to heed, it was found again that the traffic in evil and its ramifications all over the land and even to foreign countries was in the hands of Jews. There was no doubt about it. There was even no accident about it. The fact was as continuous as it was colossal. William Travers Jerome, then Justice of the Court of Special Sessions, made in 1901 a ringing indictment of conditions in the city and used the full power of his court to punish wrongdoers. He even went so far as to specify individuals and political connections, but he did not mention the key word of it all, which was Jew. It was doubtless wise for him that he did not, else he could not have enjoyed the subsequent political career which came to him.
See? Same thing they do today.
Tammany was defeated in the election of 1901. The defeat was due to the same cause, the stigma of Jew-controlled vice traffic under political protection. It was at this time that Richard Croker abdicated. He was a rich man. He sailed for Ireland, where he became a country squire on his wantage estate. Public curiosity was fed the statement that Croker had selected Lewis Nixon to be his successor. But this turn in Tammany's career is too important to be thus misstated. The truth is that when Croker left, he surrendered Tammany to the Jews.
You know, there's some information I got on Richard Croker. He's very important in this because he's the one that, as they say here, actually, he was an Irishman, abdicated the whole thing to the Jews, even though the Jews had been kind of running it. And he became very, very rich during that time. And it's said that he received bribe money from the owners of brothels, saloons, and illegal gambling dens, and all of that. So either he willfully went along with it, or they laid all that on him. Was maybe he didn't have that much say about it. I don't know. But he was the last real boss, real true boss of Tammany, I guess.
Croker could confirm this if he would talk, if he should be permitted to talk. It is, however, not well to have garrulous old men spilling the secrets of other days. Croker, in his age, took a bride who is said to be of Indian descent, and he has not been much in touch with his family nor the public since.
Well, now, he was 71 when he married her. And he died when he was 79. This all took place in Ireland after he had left. He had his first wife died the same year, 1914, and that's when he married this other woman. So you'd think that he maybe already knew her.
Well, it puts Indian descent in quotation marks, so you wonder what that really means.
Her name didn't say. Her name was Beulah. And the last name was kind of a, you know, ordinary type name. So it didn't sound Indian, but I guess she was must have been said that she had some Indian blood in her.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Beulah Red Cloud or whatever.
Huh.
No. Lewis Nixon was the convenient and perhaps unconscious Gentile front. The real ruler of Tammany in Croker's stead was Andrew Freedman, mentioned in the former article as Croker's friend and housemate. Now stop it. Judging from the habit of individual Jews to room with baseball players before the baseball scandal, and the result of another Jew's living with Croker, it might be just as well to keep an eye on those other men who are in positions to do favors or influence legislation, whose close cronies happen to be Jews. Some of these friendships may indeed be perfectly conceived, but there are numerous instances where the plans of the Jewish friend are very completely matured through the agency of the Gentile chum.
Well, that's where, you know, you wonder what these Jews are doing for the Gentiles, that they would want to actually live with them. But it seems to be something that does happen. It's similar to the Jews who go and get jobs with the, you know, with the head people or in the back when, you know, with the king, with the duke, with the, you know, with the big landowner and so on. As kind of like advisors and friends, they seem to be able to insinuate themselves and make themselves so helpful that this person soon, this non-Jewish person soon feels like they can hardly function without them. That's what I think, how they do it. And then they end up enriching themselves and getting the control, which we'll see with Friedman here.
Yep. So upon the departure of Croker from these shores, we find Tammany under the dictatorship of a Jew who was Croker's chief influence, if not his absolute master. Oops.
But by the time this occurred, it was useless for Tammany to rebel. Now, this is a real important sentence. I've got this enlarged. Tammany men who had noticed the infiltration of Jews and were alarmed by it had consoled themselves with the thought that at least the higher offices were immune from Jewish occupation. Now, how familiar is this? And in white nationalism, too. So, well, as long as we don't have Jews in our higher level, they're okay. Well, we'll see what happened here with them.
Yeah, well, you know, if you have Jews in an organization, they're going to exert some influence. You know, they'll
make points. Oh, absolutely. You can't have them. They just know how to move up and take over. They just know how to do it.
Yeah.
These people, imagine that they're, you know, that they're smart enough. Oh, we'll watch and we will. Yeah, they never.
Yeah, right.
Never are.
This consolation served only to permit the filling of the lower offices by Jews with less protest from the membership. By the time the Jews were ready to permit Croker to abdicate, they had permeated every part of the wigwam, and the assumption of supreme control was thus made a simple matter. Croker stepped aside. Instantly into his place stepped the Jew Friedman, operating through Nixon. It was too late for Tammany to remonstrate. Tammany could not protest against the wigwam becoming Jewish because the wigwam already was Jewish. To remonstrate then was to ruin Tammany. Becoming reconciled to what seemed to be inevitable, Tammany leaders saw that their only hope of survival came through preserving Jewish support.
There you go. There you go. They couldn't get along. They couldn't get rid of them then. It was too late.
Presently, even Nixon was relegated to the background, and Friedman issued his orders directly. The Jews, however, with great astuteness, continued to make much of Nixon because he was the last thin veil which concealed the change which had come over Tammany, and he was valuable to that extent. He was, unwillingly perhaps, their puppet. But even puppets must be accorded their proper dignity. Nixon was tendered a great reception in 1902, but the influential men on the reception committee were mostly Jews. Andrew Friedman was chairman, then followed the names of Oliver H. P. Belmont, Max F. Eamson, Samuel Untermeyer, Nathan Strauss, Randolph Guggenheimer, Henry M. Goldfogel, Herman Joseph, and others.
All Jews.
On the executive committee of Tammany Hall at this time were Randolph Guggenheimer, Isaac Fromm, Nathan Strauss, Henry M. Goldfogel, O. H. P. Belmont, and other Jews. On the committee on law were Samuel Untermeyer, M. Warlett Platzek, Abraham Levy, Henry W. Unger, Morris Cooker, and Fred B. House. Andrew Friedman had complete control of the Committee on Finance that was nominally headed by Lewis Nixon. Randolph Guggenheimer was president of the Municipal Council. Ferdinand Levy was on the Committee on Resolutions and Correspondence. Jews had so spread themselves as to constitute a controlling group in all the assembly districts that were under tribute to Tammany. In the Fighting Eighth District, Martin Engel was leader. His chief aide was Manny Eichner, chairman of the Isidore Cohn Association and of the Young Men's Democratic Association. His other assistants, Max J. Porges, Max Levain, and Mo Levy, were floor managers of the dances and balls of the Florence Sullivan Association. In the 10th District, Simon Steingut, mayor of Second Avenue, was one of the hardest workers in Tammany affairs. Edward Mandel was the active Jewish Tammany man in the 12th District. In the 18th District, Morris Blumenthal was one of the principal workers. He devoted his career chiefly to the training of Jewish speakers for the wigwam. The 18th District was known as the Gas House District, notorious for the gas house scandals over padded payrolls, and here Charlie Murphy ruled, his aides being Julius Simon, Edward E. Slumaski, Joseph Schlesinger, Leopold Worms, Hugo Siegel, Alfred B. Marx, Nathan Fernbacher, and other Jews.
Well, and now, so you see, if they've got all these Jews, I mean, if they've got all these people around the city, somebody is encouraging them to run for these offices, you know, to take control, to be the representative in the 10th district, in the 12th district, in the 18th district, and so on. And even that is conspiratorial. I'm not saying that it's criminal conspiratorial, but they are moving toward, you know, building up their own influence as much as possible.
Anyway. However, the Jews made their cyclically recurring mistakes. Oh, wait, I left out a sentence.
No.
And so on through the list. Among the sachems of the Tammany society, there were to be found the wealthier and more socially exalted Jews. However, the Jews made their cyclically recurring mistakes. They carried things with too high a hand, and a rebellion broke out. It is this Jewish tendency to boast and overdo that has always given the game away. Superficial observers and writers like John Spargo and Norman Hapgood have observed the recurrent periods of protest against Jewish presumption and bumptiousness and have explained them as being recurrent spasms of a vile poison which is supposed to reside in the blood of the Gentiles. The vile poison of anti-Semitism. That, of course, is the conventional Jewish propagandist explanation, and Spargo and Hapgood are merely retailing it. They say it always breaks out after wars. Why after wars? Because in wars, the world sees more clearly than at other times the real purpose and personality of the Jew. Thus, it is not anti-Semitism that breaks out. It is Semitism. Gross and exaggerated Semitism. Mm-hmm. And the serum that forms in the social body to insist and control the germ of Semitism comes in the form of public exposure and protest. That serum is working now. The serum of publicity and the Jewish program cannot endure it.
Think that's true. You know, I think it's true that publicity, the Jewish program cannot endure the publicity, and there's not enough publicity about it. Well, that's why they work. Their biggest job is to suppress publicity about what they're doing, you know, and truth-telling about what they're doing. So that's the most important thing there is to do.
Sorry. Spinning and constantly offering alternate conspiracy theories and also trying to discredit actual criticism.
Yeah.
Study the history of all things whatsoever into which Jews inject themselves, from summer resorts to empires, and you see the same cycle reappearing. Thus it happened in Tammany Hall. Too much Jew engendered revolt. Lewis Nixon became aware of his position. As a gentleman of standing and responsibility, he could not continue in a position whose falsity had become clear to him. When he accepted the leadership of Tammany Hall, it was not with a purpose to continue the old order. His understanding was that he was to be left free to restore Tammany to the plane of its former serious purpose and respectable character. He discovered that he was being used as the respectable Gentile front, behind whose name the Jews expected to carry on the old game. Therefore, in May 1902, 3 months after the great reception above mentioned, Nixon resigned as leader of Tammany Hall. Doubtless the reception that was tendered him was for the purpose of inducing him to love the exaltation of his position so much that he would sacrifice its moral obligations. They love to get these puppets that are just intoxicated with the appearance of power.
Yeah, like Barack Obama.
Yep. Or W is an even more obvious example.
Oh, I don't know. He's more.
Nixon accompanied his resignation with a speech in which he protested that ever since he had accepted the leadership of Tammany, he had been hampered in his every action by a group headed by Andrew Friedman. They dictated the names that were to be placed on the list of sachems. When I rebelled, I found that at every turn I would be opposed by this coterie of interferers. I found that all my important acts had to be vised before they could become effective. He said he could no longer retain his position and his self-respect. His position and his self-respect. He had to give up one or the other. With this, Mr. Nixon vanished from the scene of Tammany politics. The resignation of Mr. Nixon had a bad effect on the reputation of Tammany with the public. The plan had been to allow him to serve as long as ordinarily and then replace him with a Jew by means of the usual process of selection. But the resignation and the explanation that accompanied it, showing as it did the Jewish influence in Tammany, made it seem inadvisable to follow with a Jewish leader. So the district leaders were obliged to find another Gentile front, only this time one who would prove sufficiently docile. There was enough rankling disfavor against the Jews in the old organization to warrant this observance of appearances, at least. The dictatorship of Friedman was seen to be a failure, much as the dictatorship of Trotsky is seen to be a failure. A rearrangement of committees automatically eliminated him from control. At the same time, the name of Croker was dropped. A triumvirate of leaders was chosen, of whom Charles F. Murphy became and remains the chief. Boss Murphy, he is called. Mr. Murphy has been an ideal front, not attempting to do anything, not attempting to interfere with the Jews doing anything, keeping wisely silent and thereby gaining a reputation for silent wisdom. Mr. Murphy is a millionaire. Those who do the higher Jewish leaders' bidding get their reward that way. There is no other reward they can hope for. Certainly, they never have the reward of public confidence and the people's gratitude. That is the status of Tammany Hall at the present time. A few of the old guard are left at their posts, but they are officers in name only. Tammany is no longer denounced by the public press, but the Jewish leaders of Tammany live daily to a chorus of praise in the Jewish-controlled newspapers of New York. Samuel Untermeyer, for example, receives more publicity in New York than does the President of the United States. But it is not discriminating publicity. It does not penetrate to the inner purposes and consequences of his actions.
Better speed up just a little bit.
Those who were the lesser Jewish lieutenants of Tammany a few years ago have now arrived at posts of influence and affluence. Morris Cooker was made president of the Municipal Service Commission to be succeeded by former state senator Abraham Kaplan, Fred V. House rose to be a city magistrate. The city marshals are mostly Jewish. Jews predominate in the College of the City of New York. Jews control the municipal courts, the city magistrates' courts, the city court, the New York State Court of Appeals, the New York State Supreme Court. They rule in the departments enumerated in the forepart of this article. The New York judiciary has a distinctly Semitic complexion. The leadership of the Tammany-controlled district tells the same story. In the second, the leader is M.S. Levine. In the sixth, David Lazarus. In the eighth, S. Goldenkrantz, F. Bauman, and S. Salinger. In the ninth, Mrs. P. Lau. In the seventh, Nathan Birkin, and so on. The Jewish conquest of Tammany, however, is only one phase of the conquest of New York. The Jewish objective is more than political, merely to strive that the lucrative and powerful officers of the city shall fall to their people is not the end in view. New York has been turned into the red center of America. There, most of the alien treason carried on against the government of the United States has its source. The United States government has been compelled at times to regard New York as almost alien soil. But even that watchfulness on the part of the national government is relaxed as Jewish influence becomes more potent at Washington. Tammany is a convenient cover for ostensible political activity, as the Kahila is for the more radical racial and anti-American racial activity. The United States government could not do better than to investigate, through a committee of invulnerable Americans, the Jewish activities of that center. And that there is much to investigate is indicated by the rush of Jews to Washington when it was recently proposed in the United States Senate that such a thing be done.
Uh-huh. October 1st, 1921. Well, yes. You know, this last sentence here, they're saying that it was recently proposed in the United States Senate that there be an investigation of the New York Kahila, I guess. And that's what how I take it. And so all these, they noticed Jews rushing to be in Washington. I don't know how that rush was, but... you know, this is another thing where they joined together to protect themselves. And what I liked here was this sentence up a little ways. New York has been turned into the red center of America. Well, this is what the international Jew, this is what Henry Ford thought, you know. And here's where they say that Tammany was one phase of the conquest of New York. And then New York, the conquest of New York was in part of the phase of the conquest of the USA, and I would say they have succeeded in that. Wouldn't you say that, Hannon?
Well, when they got control of mass media or dominance of mass media, that was really it right there.
Well, they already had control, they said, of the New York press back then.
Well, the big thing was when broadcasting started, and they got in on the ground floor of broadcasting For a long time there were no major television networks, for example, that weren't under Jewish direction.
Yeah. Well, okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week. Good night for Hattie and I.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.